It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. Guitarist Brian Jones formed the Rolling Stones, recruited Mick Jagger and Keith Richards to join the band, and gave the group its name. Eventually, Jones was fired from his own band, and a month later was found dead at the bottom of a swimming pool at age 27. The rest of the Stones just celebrated their 50th year in rock and roll. Music writer Paul Chrinka has been around the musical block. He's written books about Bowie and Iggy Pop, and he interviewed a long list of rock and roll insiders for his book, Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones. And we welcome Paul Chrinka to the show. Paul, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Steve. It's a pleasure.
When it comes to the story of the Rolling Stones, as you write yourself in the book, it would seem that history is written by the victors. So do Keith and Mick take too much credit?
Simple answer to that is yes, they do. You'll see on Keith's biography on Amazon that he described himself as the founder of the Rolling Stones, and he wasn't. It was Brian Jones who formed the band, individually handpicked all the members. Even the guys that Mick and Keith knew, he picked them. You know, he chose the set. Mick and Keith are fantastic musicians, you know, and they, you know, were wonderful songwriters. But when it comes down to it, it was Brian's band and Brian's vision.
Well, you interviewed Keith Richards a fair amount over the years and used that info in the book. Did Keith ever contradict himself when he then wrote that biography, Life, which came out a little while ago?
Keith has just got, you know, bless him, has just got this strange, almost crystallized version of history where he just tends to repeat the same stories again and again. There is insight. You can talk to him and he'll say, yes, I feel bad about this. But I think everybody is so damaged by that period, almost psychically, it is very difficult for them to go back. You know, other people will say that when you speak to Mick or Keith about Brian, they just kind of clam up and go quiet. You know, so I think, in a strange way, they were kids when all of this happened, and they didn't treat him very well. You know, he was by no means a perfect person either, but I think they all came out of it with a lot of trauma, and I think they're in denial.
It's interesting to look at how Keith and Mick and the other Stones have dealt with Brian after his death. There's been at least one song that has been written about Brian. But you'd think that all these years later, even if they hated him when they split, they would somehow have some kind of warmer recollection. That doesn't seem to be the case.
You would think that, wouldn't you? But then you'd also think that Keith would be warm about Mick. And I've just been staggered by the sheer hatred on display, you know, interviewing Keith about Mick, or the way they talk about Bill Wyman. It's outrageous. And then actually when you see them on stage now, and I saw them with Bill Wyman playing, there was no eye contact. They didn't even look at him. And Mick and Keith actually only looked at each other during the set, just at one point when they walked down a big ramp into the audience. That's the only time they looked at each other. So we are talking about a strange, dysfunctional group of people whose psychology is just very damaged. So I agree. Brian was there for them. He gave them their job. They owe him in a way. You know, even if they detest him, they owe him, and he was a friend. But one gets no trace of that. But then one gets no trace of that about the other people who've helped them, really.
We're talking Paul Chrinka. His book, Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones, is out now in paperback in the U.S., and it traces the early years of the Rolling Stones and their founder, Brian Jones. So as you mentioned, Paul, the songs, the hits especially, were listed as being composed by Jagger and Richards. But for some of those songs in the Jones era, you challenge those writing credits.
Well, it's certainly true that in songs like Ruby Tuesday, Brian came up with the initial melody. He came up with the initial melody for Painted Black as well. That arrived in a jam that Brian had with Bill Wyman. You know, and so a lot of this is on the record. But, of course, they would just put their brand on it. And in those days, people weren't that sophisticated. Andrew Oldham set up the sort of Jagger Richards songwriting credit because he wanted to copy the Lennon-McCartney. So even if they were band compositions, they'd go down to Jagger Richards. That's just the way it was. And it wasn't a very sophisticated business back then. And but that said, you know, what seems to be worse is there are odd songs like Play With Fire that were credited to the group via a credit called Nanka Felge, and they reverted to Jagger Richards. And who knows what has happened there. But you know, even to this day, they'll go, oh, he couldn't write songs. And that, you know, again, they're in a kind of denial, because I think they're denying that he took a lot of their early songs and either provided the sort of seed from which they grew, or else he provided the flourish that made them into songs. And that happened a lot, and I put it on the record with people who were there. So I think it takes what were kind of vague allegations in the past, and I think we have, you know, pretty much established. I want to be fair to Mick and Keith, because I like them. I think they're incredibly talented people. But, you know, we have to get the record straight, and now is the right time to do it.
Well, what Brian Jones did bring was the outlaw mentality that transferred from the blues to rock and roll. How did Brian Jones discover the blues?
He came to the blues via trad jazz, you know, which is a very British thing, in Cheltenham, where he grew up. It was kind of quite a middle class but quite a hip area. There were a lot of people from C&D, the campaign for nuclear disarmament, and they would, their way of rebelling, you know, was to search out this music. You know, they had a few good local record stores, so he discovered his first blues records, probably people like Big Bill Brunsey from the trad jazz people, also from, you know, the early days of Alexis Corner, who was a very important influence. And then he went and he kind of drilled down incredibly deep. You know, he knew the work of Robert Johnson really early on. He found books that describe Johnson's life. And this is the kind of thing that nobody in America would have known, you know, outside of the black community. He really searched out this stuff before almost anybody else, did. And it was really quite amazing. I think it is because he identified with it, and in a way it represented an escape from his own kind of dreary middle class life and the future that his parents had mapped out for him.
So much so that he decided that this was his path. He moved to London to pursue this. But how much was he playing blues music before that?
He was, I found a chap called John Keane who had a jazz band with whom Brian played, and they do jazz gigs that John had booked, and then they do blues gigs that Brian had booked. So they do, you know, Dust My Broom, they do Elmore James songs, they do things like St. James Infirmary and Careless Love that were both blues and jazz classics. He was doing acoustic blues numbers with another guy, and in fact he'd probably racked up, I reckon, 100 shows before he came to London. And it's an interesting comparison with Mick and Keith, because they because Mick had only ever played in his parents' front room, you know, so he was really the one he'd learned an incredible amount over that process. So we know people like Eric Clapton, who learned the blues, just sort of monstered their way through it, you know, in 1963 or so, and then Brian was doing it in 1961 or 1962. He was a real pioneer and the key visionary of that generation of musicians, I think.
Well, guys like Clapton, even though, of course, they, you know, very much became part of a rock scene that wasn't traditional blues, are sort of seen as more blues purists in the long run. And I kind of think that's how some people think of Brian Jones, because they were playing so many old blues songs when he formed the band. That's what they started as. But you give Brian Jones a lot of credit for being at the vanguard of cutting edge music. He was very interested with...
Yes, it's true, because it's often said he was a purist. He didn't want to play the blues. And that's what Andrew Oldham said, that he would turn his nose. He was superior about pop music. And, of course, it's demonstrably untrue, because he was the most eclectic out of all of them. He was the one who was searching out these other musics and bringing in these other influences, and in the process, making them incredibly hip. In 1965, 1966, Mick Jagger was not a hip person in swinging London. You know, it was Brian who was out there. He was doing the drugs, which ultimately didn't have a good effect. You know, he was there. He walked it like he talked it, and he looked amazing. He was almost the first of these peacock males who dress in androgynous style. You know, so we wouldn't have had glam. We wouldn't have had David Bowie or whoever without Brian Jones. So he was the one, you know, and in some ways, he was doing that because he knew he was being pushed out. This was his way of asserting himself. But he was pushing the envelope, really more so than any individual of that generation, you know, certainly more so than his fellow Stones.
He was an early advocate for Jimi Hendrix. They were friends, and he advocated for that band.
Yeah, he introduced Jimi at Monterey. He would go to a lot of trouble for him. And they loved each other. You know, they were very close to each other. Maybe they were both kind of naive in a similar kind of way. But Brian was a reach-out stone. So when you look at people like Andy Warhol, it was Brian who teamed up with those people. If you look at people like Jack Nietzsche, who produced effectively or certainly was a musical director for a lot of the Stones' key early records, that was a relationship that Brian handled. He was friends with Dennis Hopper, all of the West Coast scene. So it's bizarre when you hear Mick and Keith talk about Brian as being sort of uptight and paranoid, when you know the rest of the guys just used to stay there in their own little comfort zone. It was Brian who went out and hung out with other people. He was a mass of contradictions, obviously, but he pushed pop music a long way in a very short time.
We're talking with Paul Trinka. He is the author of Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones, which takes a look at the early years of the band and their founder, Brian Jones, who was essentially pushed out of the band and then died very shortly after that. What was the official statement, Paul, of the police on the cause of death for Brian Jones?
The police said it was misadventure. And although the report was very perfunctory, and there are people who suspect foul play, it still represents the most convincing scenario, because there have been various murder scenarios since then which would require a lot of people to work with split-second timing, would involve, you know, a heck of a cover-up. So, you know, it's a bit like the false flag 9/11 stories that are completely Byzantine in their complexity. The fact is that Brian was persecuted by the police. You know, there certainly was a cover-up of that. But he was in poor health, despite other reports. And people who knew him, who really had spent time with him, just thought he wasn't long for this world. So sadly, I think, you know, a bit of the life force had gone out of him. But at the same time, on the positive aspect, he had actually changed the face of the world. You know, the music we all hear today, he helped re-engineer all of it. And so I think in many ways, I think he probably did know that he'd achieved what he set out to do.
Did Brian Jones do more drugs or drink more than the other Rolling Stones during the time that he was in the band?
Simple answer, yes. The thing about Brian Jones, as somebody once told me, is that he was never satisfied. So that's what kept him pushing, trying out new instruments, new sounds, checking out new records, and that applied to drugs as well. So he'd try one drug, and that was never enough. He had to try the next one. And it's really worth pointing out that whilst he did that, he remained in a reasonable functional state. But it was only after there were basically all the police trying to get him that he pretty much gave up on illegal drugs and took prescription drugs, Quaaludes or Mandrax, I think they're called in the States. And those had a terrible effect on him. But those were actually legal prescription drugs, and they're really what helped remove his musical abilities. So it's actually those that ultimately had more effect than, you know, trying acid or dope or drink, which he was certainly unhealthily addicted to as well.
You mentioned police persecution. It seems like all the Stones were getting busted there for a while. Yet Jones is the one who seemed the most at risk early on to have his legal problems actually derail the band.
Yeah, I mean, but there are people who say that it was Jones who the police really wanted to get, because he was the most outrageous figure. Jagger was well known. Jones was actually out there living the life, you know, dressing up like a girl. So it's exactly the kind of thing that the tabloids and newspapers hated. The main Stones bust at Redlands, that bust was all organized with the police and the various informants from the newspapers. They all thought that Brian Jones was going to be there. And then because they missed him first time round, they made a point of trying to get him the second time round. And there were at least seven attempted busts, most of them led by a detective who was later convicted of perjury and of fitting people up, the infamous Norman Pilcher, or Semolina Pilchard, as Lennon called him. And it was war, and Brian was right at the forefront of the war, and he didn't really have the toughness of somebody like Mick Jagger, you know, who himself was very near to breaking. And I think it's more true to say that Brian was broken by that and by, I guess, the betrayal of his Stones when Keith ran off with Anita and they just abandoned him. These guys he thought of as brothers, when they abandoned him in Morocco.
Well, you talk about those rivalries and the romantic rivalry with Keith and Brian over Anita Pallenberg. was that a situation where the band was pretty much set to break up? What ended up happening was, well, you can explain it better than me, but Brian did get busted, and that was going to put one of their tours in jeopardy, and that was around the time of their split. But there were a lot of other divisions going on at the same time.
Well, of course, rock and roll, you know, in 1963, people thought it would last a couple of years. So we can talk about all of this with hindsight and talk about how people should have been much more mature or more careful. But, you know, this business was new. Nobody understood it, you know, not the record companies and certainly not the managers. And also, rock and roll bands, you know, as anybody who's been in one, including me, will tell you, you know, there's times when they just hate each other. And the Rolling Stones were especially bad in terms of using women as chattels to establish their superiority amongst one another. They were like a dog pack. All of them were. Maybe Keith not so much as the others, but they were trying to nick each other's girlfriends right from the start. So, you know, perhaps rather than say, hey, you know, they should have kept Brian in the band, perhaps it's a surprise that they all stayed together as long as they did. And certainly it would have been better for Brian. He was contemplating leaving in 1965, and I'm sure it would have been much better for him if he had done so at the time. But then he met Anita Pallenberg and decided for kind of one last throw of the dice.
Andrew Luke Oldham came on as manager of the Stones. And as you mentioned, he encouraged the songwriting credit, Jagger Richards, and he seemed to favor Jagger over Brian.
And as Oldham's business manager said, it's just because he fancied Mick more than the others. And I think that's true. I don't think he would particularly deny it himself. It's fairly much there in the book. And also, it was a question of divide and rule. You know, Andrew was young and inexperienced. He wanted to get a hold over the band, and he did so by sort of focusing on Jagger and creating him as his creature. But of course, Andrew emerged equally damaged from the process. So I would only kind of criticize Andrew necessarily for his revisionism, but, you know, obviously he made mistakes, but anybody would in those circumstances. And but Andrew, he really lost his mind over a period as well. His memory is severely damaged now because he basically checked himself in for ECT treatment because he thought he was going mad. So the whole process was very much on the edge. And when you read about what went on, you know, it is quite traumatizing, but at the same time it produced great music. That dark energy we hear in the Stones, that nastiness, that kind of aggression, that fear, that's all real. They were in the middle of it all.
Andrew Oldham is quoted as saying Brian wanted fame and blues purity in equal lethal barrels. When I read that quote, it sounds a little bit like Kurt Cobain, you know, punk rock ethics but the desire to be a rock star. And then of course they both died young.
Well, it's a slick quote, but there is truth to it. And it's very hard to get through to Andrew and find out what he really thinks. But in a way, that there is a truth to it. Brian was always searching for something. He'd been fairly much rejected by his parents, so he so dreadfully wanted what we'd, you know, what today we'd call validation. And he also really cared about that music. And perhaps he did achieve that in death. So people always look upon his death as a terrible tragedy, and it was. But sometimes I think, was it part of a path he had mapped out for himself? But he wasn't. That Andrew Oldham quote maybe sort of implies he was sort of limited in his views, and he wasn't, you know. But he was searching for something in the music, and I think he got there, really.
Paul Trinka is the author of Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones. He's been talking to us this hour. Paul, thanks for being with us today.
Steve, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.